KQED Public Radio in San Francisco. I'm Michael Krasny. Coming up next on this special Thanksgiving edition of Forum, first we bring you my interview with actor Alec Baldwin. He's returning to public radio and the third season of his talk show, Here's the Thing. That's set to air on KQED starting January 3rd. Then at 10:30, to whet your appetite, Chef Jacques Pepin. Many of us grew up watching him create delicious meals on television. He tells us what he's learned from 60 years of cooking with friends and family. And that's all coming up next on Forum after this. From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny, and welcome to another hour of this morning's Forum program. My guest is actor Alec Baldwin, who has garnered multiple awards for his work in movies, television, and Broadway. He's also delved into public radio, where he hosts a talk show called Here's the Thing. The show is a unique entree into the lives of celebrities like Julie Andrews, John McEnroe, and Sarah Jessica Parker. He kicks off the third season on KQED Public Radio on January 3rd, and when I spoke with Alec, we started off by listening to a clip of him interviewing Ira Glass, the host of This American Life.
When did you realize you didn't believe in God? How old were you?
Teenager.
Did you grow up in a religious household?
I grew up, we were Jews in the suburbs. I went to Hebrew school and then went to like the high school version of that. Like I continued past my bar mitzvah. And at some point I realized it just didn't add up. There's another explanation for everything around me, which makes more sense than there's a big dad who created this all.
And what was your explanation?
Just, you know, universe has been here. There was like some sort of something happened.
Yeah, Big Bang.
Yeah, something like, you know.
Tadpole people climbed up on the shores of
I remember arguing that in Hebrew college with my professors. They did not buy it at all.
You probably got slapped like young Woody Allen in radio days. How dare you mention this? And they cracked you.
Are you an atheist?
No. I don't know what I believe in terms of the specific. I don't know. I had a Catholic priest once say to me, listen, I believe in a piece of many religions.
Well, that's a good conversation. I mean, it's rich. You're getting into, my mother used to say, never discuss sex, politics, or religion, but you're getting into the thick of it there.
Well, we make an effort at talking about different things with them. If they warm up to it, fine, and then we run in that direction and cut it into the show. And if it goes dry, then we just abandon that and move on. I mean, there are people we've talked to who especially early on when I was first beginning, you'd head in different directions. But the most important thing is that you want people to be comfortable. These are people who I respect. And I don't think I'd have anybody on who I didn't really like in terms of their talent.
It's a skill set, though. I mean, I remember when Charles Grodin decided to move and, you know, you've been a very famed and much celebrated actor, not only, by the way, I ought to say, in films and television, but also on the stage, and I've admired your work. But to go into something like engaging conversations and building rapport with people and doing all that you need to do, have that chemistry going for you, it's a skill set.
Well, I mean, it's one I'm trying to develop, and over time I feel like you find the rhythms with people where they, you know, when they're done, they're talking about some part of their life, and they're either giving you a very, I don't want to say canned, but a practiced response. I mean, some of the people we've spoken to are legends, and they're very old school, and you know, they're not there to find out anything new about themselves. A conversation sometimes can have a lot of surprises in it, and for some of these people, that's not going to happen, which is okay. And you still try to, you know, find out. Julie Andrews came on, and one of the things that fascinated me about her was, does she miss England? I mean, she's, you know, she's one of the great exports, British exports of all time, and yet she's and she's spent time there and has a home in Europe, and she's very proud about her roots there and everything. But she lived for the most, for the preponderance of her adult life in Malibu with Blake Edwards. And I just talked about, you know, the Rose of England going over to California, what that was like. And I thought that was interesting what she talked about. But and Sarah Jessica Parker to talk about what it was like for her to change the fortunes of a company that she and – I would have asked Gandolfini the same question if he were alive, which was for the two of them with obviously The Sopranos and Sex and the City. They changed the fortunes of HBO, which did not have – a winning original programming slate. For everybody that remembers the old HBO, they showed the same movies all the time. They had that Israeli folk dance theme song they would play. Do you remember the old HBO
theme
song?
Yes, I do. I do. And in fact,
you thought there was going to
be that all changed the industry, changed the movie industry too, because you could do things on HBO that were done in motion pictures, so to speak, or on the big screen.
Well, eventually, yeah. I mean, in the early HBO just had that Michael Benben show, Dream On, that very strange show that came on. That was their first original show. But when Sex and the City and The Sopranos came and were doing numbers and were drawing audiences that competed with Kate with network TV, then everything changed. And I asked her what that was like to have success later in her career and to have all that put on her shoulders. She was obviously the star and the focus of the show.
Well, we have a clip from that interview with Sarah Jessica Parker, and Alec Baldwin asked her about what life was like after the fame of that show and when she suddenly found she was in the driver's seat and could choose which actor she wanted to play opposite in her romantic movies.
My problem was that I knew what I was going to have to do on screen with them. And I think there's something very interesting about that, which is hard to explain to people, but you and I can get into it now. So you know when they've given you somebody to play opposite and you know what they won't bring and you know what you will then have to do is tell the story for two people on camera. You end up projecting onto the other person what you wish they were bringing into the scene. And what I think happens is you become a bad actor. You overact.
That's a fascinating
You try to create chemistry and romance and love and...
You imbue the scene with everything.
And you can't, because when you feel it, even if you're not in love with this person, I've worked with countless actors who I'm not in love with them. I really mean it. But I love working with them. And
yes.
I can... If they're smart and interesting and talented...
They're good actors.
I do not care.
Talent is the greatest aphrodisiac.
Yeah, I think it was Elizabeth Taylor who said that. No, actually, she said success is the greatest aphrodisiac. We're talking to Alec Baldwin, and he has begun his third season of Here's the Thing, which will be broadcast on our air on KQED, and did those kind of interviews, which, you know, what you hear in the work that you're doing there is not only wanting to bring these people out, not only following your own curiosity, but really being engaged with them and wanting to respond to them. It's kind of a little bit like a tennis game, isn't it?
Well, the other thing you think about, what's weird is you, the path for me is that you think about who you want to interview, and most of the people that I want to interview are dead. You know, when you really think about it, you think, who do I want to talk to? Well, I want to talk to Bogart. Let's get him in here. Oh, he's dead. Okay. I want to talk to Ingrid Bergman. Now she's not around either. What about Barbara Stanwyck? Let's get her in here. And when you go through the whole list of people you really want to talk to, the next game I play with myself is, well, who is that person now? Who is Bill Holden now? Who is Elizabeth Taylor now? And that's in the show business matrix. I try to think beyond that as much as possible, because sometimes we turn around and show business conversations, because those people are so velvety sometimes in terms of their promotional duties, they tend to be – or at least they seem like they're better shows and they're better interviews.
Didn't you once say that you slid into show business? You're an actor, but you because you're using that term show business here. I'm struck by that. What do you mean by saying that
slid
into show business?
Well, show business is all of the promotion.
Yeah.
Show business is all of the promotion of the product. I mean, it's not lost on you, I'm sure, that I'm doing a talk show with you now about a talk show I'm doing.
Not lost on me at all.
It's kind of meta for me. It's a little bit too meta for me, actually. But here we are, you know, doing a show, you and I talking about my talk show, which I find strange. But nonetheless, people come to you and say, we want you to promote the show and so forth. And that's cool. I mean, we do a little bit of that. But I find that the business in my lifetime is you shoot a film. If you played a lead in a worthwhile film, not some quickie thing, if you did a lead in a good film, when I first started years ago, that meant you were going to work 8, 10, 12 weeks of shooting. And when that was over, you were going to have a certain amount of time. They'd ask you to block out, you know, a couple of weeks to promote. And I'm literally here to tell you that in the independent film world, for example, it's completely flipped. You shoot for 2 weeks, and they want you to spend 8, 10, 12 weeks going to festivals and going to press conferences and going to markets and helping to sell. You are their partner. They do not hesitate to indicate to you, you are our partner. And a lot, if not everything, is riding on you getting out there and helping us to sell the film in the marketplace. And it's become overwhelming, actually.
Yeah, I know you and James Toback, in fact, did a bit of a parody on that whole idea of what show business is like in the movie industry. You know, since we don't want to necessarily talk about show business I'm wondering about
Let's talk about Michael Vick. No, go ahead.
Well, he's redeemed himself. Maybe that's a good segue. There are some people who feel you need to redeem yourself for, well, things that you, in fact, you know, I went back and listened to that word that got you in all that hot water with GLAAD and with people deciding to be judges of you and your
what
character.
Did you listen to and what did you take away from that? What did you
I give you the honest takeaway. I did not hear the F word.
Right, there you go.
I honestly did not. Right. I didn't hear fathead. Excuse me. I didn't hear fathead.
Oh, no, but me saying fathead was a joke. What I said was, number one, when you have these kind of unpleasant altercations with these people, I don't leap in the car afterward and pull out a pad and take notes and say, well, now what did I say? Let me write down what I said so I'm clear about this. I mean, it's
– Excuse me, Alec. I should say to listeners, you were accused of using an anti-gay epithet. I think not
right,
necessarily
right.
Everybody
and
knows what we're
more
talking
important,
about.
But what's even more important, because and this is something I've had to deal with, is that even if I didn't say that word, I said other words that people in that community do construe as homophobic.
But you know, here you are. You're a film actor. You had this wonderful run with Tina Fey. You were certainly iconic in so many ways, producing films and noted for a philanthropist and giving a lot back to the community and everything. And it's really regretful to many people, although many people like to vilify you and see you as the enemy, but it's regretful to many people that suddenly you have this hanging on your back and on your head.
Well, I think the thing that what it's done for me is that I learned a profound lesson. I could walk into a room full of my friends, gay and straight, and I could turn to someone and say, come on over here, you little queen, and my friends could laugh. Everyone would laugh because I'm entitled to say that because they're my friends. If you say that in public and you use that word in public, those people who aren't your friends are offended by that. I mean, there is that double-edged thing going on.
Well, that was something you did say, toxic little queen, you actually did say after.
Right, right. But yeah. That's what I'm saying. There are words I've used. There's things I've said that I've learned. You're better off if you don't. I mean, you are offending some quotient of the population. There is a very, very strident and very, very aggressive component out there that wants people to stop saying these kinds of things and using that kind of language that's hurtful. And I have learned that lesson. At the same time, what I've learned is that that whole thing can go too far insofar as not a condemnation of inappropriate language, but just this kind of trial in the media that we live by now. You know, there is no correction page on the internet. Well, you're accused of saying something, and then if it turns out you didn't, they never, you know, replay that. No one ever said to me, you know, when we play this tape back, you really didn't, just as you did. They don't say, well, on second examination, you actually didn't do this.
Things are indelible and inexorable in this new digital world. I mean, that's the world we live in, and it's a world we can lament.
Well, as a dear friend of mine once said to me, he said, there's just no forgetting anymore. I mean, you just can't, you never move past
them. There's a record of everything.
Whatever reversals you have, you never move past them.
But I'm wondering, actually, I read a piece that Lee Siegel did. I went back and read it because I remember reading it. It was a profile of you. It was actually a very affectionate profile. He said, you know, you may have wealth and glamour and power and all that, but he compared you, strangely enough, to Charlie Sheen. And he said, you're a salutary, avid living guy, an exotic guy who's an ordinary guy in many ways. I don't know if you found that flattering or not, but in many respects, it's sort of how you like to portray yourself.
Well, I think what's changed for me is that there are people who they abjure a public life and certain components of this business to the best of their ability. I mean, there's certain things they have to do, you know, there's a kind of contact with the media and the public and which feeds into a management of their public relations that they are very aggressive and very strident about, and they work very hard behind the scenes to manage that. And I never understood that. I never wanted to walk down the streets of New York with a bodyguard. I never wanted to be in and out of a car with a security. And I mean, I wanted to.
Oh, but forgive me, you wanted to go into political public life at one point, didn't you? You had those aspirations.
Oh, yeah, but that's something that's certainly out of the question and just a.
Now, but at the time.
Oh, you know, that's something I would never. Yeah, but more importantly, what I'm saying is that there's a kind of a. In relationship to the public and to the media, there was a kind of a. my trust is yours to lose sort of an ethic there that I've completely revisited. And now my attitude is you want to interact with the press and the media only on an as-needed basis.
Well, you got to do something, I suppose, about the bitterness and the anger and the rueful side of this and the sad side of this, and you just have to move on. You got a new child, and that certainly helps. I mean, congratulations, by the way. And moving out into this whole new realm of radio where you're carrying on conversations rather than learning lines, not to in any way disparage the work you've done or acting as a profession.
No. I
mean, although you've worked with David Mamet, and David Mamet sat here and actually told me, you know, he'd written this book on Stanislavski technique, and he was suggesting that maybe acting, how shall I put this? He said actors are smart people, but he said, you know, these kind of techniques, forget them.
Well, I think when he wrote his book about acting, he asked me for a quote, and the quote I gave, he laughed, and I wasn't quite sure he would use it, but indeed he did use it. And my quote for Mamet's book was, "I disagree with Mamet about every single word in this book, and yet I encourage you to devour every word in this book."
Well, that's a great blurb.
And,
and this was before or after State and Main. You worked with him on State and Main.
Right around the same time, maybe, because I'd done Glengarry in 91, and then State and Main was, I think, in 99. But Mamet is someone who he does have a very, what I would consider kind of militant view of what the relationship is between the actor and the text and the actor and the director and so forth.
And you're not misanthropic, or you're becoming less misanthropic?
I just want to do the job that I do, whether it's acting a film or do a play, or and not really concern myself so much about media. I do think that media in the world we live in, and it's not lost on me how odd it is to say this while I'm doing this program with you, but I do think that media is has an exaggerated place in our lives. And my wife and I live in an apartment. We have a TV. I used to live in an apartment when I was single, and I used to watch TV with some regularity. You know, I had the TV in the kitchen, and I had the TV in my bedroom, and I had the TV in my sitting room. And now my wife and I have one TV, and I think we have it on maybe like once a month.
Are you doing yoga? Well, your wife's a yoga teacher.
Yes.
Well, who didn't even know you. That's an amazing
story. My wife would have you believe that if I was doing yoga, I just wouldn't be having some of the problems I've had lately if I was really doing yoga.
So why'd you give up on politics? Or have you haven't completely given up on politics?
I think it's a waste of time. Yeah, I just think I think that the campaign finance system we have all but guarantees that there's just that the best possible people for the job don't want the job. We've always known that. Everybody said that even when I was in Washington going to college. And they'd say, you know, people who really, really would be great at this want nothing to do with it. They want to go into the private sector and make money. And there are good people in politics, and there used to be a lot more. And it just seems that because of our campaign finance system, there are less and less and less over time. And what passes for leadership – and by that I mean someone who is capable through some craft, through some magic, if you will, of convincing other people to do something that they believe is against their short-term interest in order to achieve something that's in their long-term interest. How do you sell them on that kind of sacrifice? That kind of leadership, selling people common sense that they already know. Much of what you say to people now when you frame the debate about certain issues, they already know. But how you sell them on being courageous enough to take the step forward and act on it about energy and about education and about public health and so forth, the leadership there, I mean, it's just disappearing.
It's not only the problem of campaign finance.
It's almost extinct.
I think, yeah, as you're suggesting, maybe too much politics has become show business, or the two have become what you're calling show business, and the two maybe too inseparable. I should also ask you, we've only got a few more minutes with you, and by the way, since you won two Emmys for 30 Rock and you won all kinds of awards for that, and people were mad about the program, and I know you love working with Tina Fey and vice versa, but were you ready for it then? Would you do it again?
Oh, I think like anything you have a relationship with, it goes up and down in terms of your, you know, your passion. And when we did the show in the beginning, I wasn't sure about it. I mean, I did it and I thought, I wasn't quite sure what it was. And the most important thing about that show was how terrified I was in the beginning, because all of them were of a certain school. All of them were very skilled and very accomplished stand-up and improv comedy talent and writers. Tina and Tracy did stand-up. Scott Adsit did improv and Jack McBrayer. And Jane Krakowski and I were the only ones who were just legit actors. You know, we didn't do a lot of comedy routines and improv. And so the first year I just was terrified. I just knew I was not as funny as them. And, you know, Tina just on her worst day is funnier than anybody else on their best day. And then the second, third season, I got relaxed more and kind of got into what I wanted to do and found a way to play the guy. And people seemed to like that. And we won a lot of awards and everything. And as we got into the end of season four, we went toward season five. I thought, well, you know, I hadn't done this in a while. I hadn't done a television series, let alone for that long. And I kind of got tired of it. And by the end of season five, which everybody agreed was our weakest season, we thought, well, let's just get out of here. So we went into six, knowing that was the end. And sure enough, we get into six and I do six and I fell in love with it again. And I thought, what am I thinking? I said, let's do this for seasons 9 and 10. But by then everybody had moved on and they had kind of crafted an ending. And I think obviously it ended because for Tina, it had to end. I mean, I think, you know, she was the one doing everything. She wrote it. She starred in it. She produced it. She worked very, very hard. She's a mom with two kids. And she just has such a host of other things to do. You know, there's so many things Tina can do in this business. She could produce and write films and act. And I think that the TV series became something that a bunch of people just thought its time was up.
Talk for just a minute. We got seconds left here, but regret about creative projects that maybe you did not pursue. I know the Jack Ryan scripts fell out when you had a falling out with Paramount. They went to Harrison Ford. But I mean, is there anything, you know, that you look back on and you think, I wish I had done that, or maybe even future, wish I could do that?
I think
aside from 30 Rock,
I'm not. Yeah. Well, my nature, I'm not the most ascended person in the world and the most evolved person in the world. But I will borrow this from other people who've told me that everything I've done led me to where I am now. And I have my wife, and I have my baby, and I love my wife, and I love my baby. And I've got to be honest with you, I really don't care about work anymore. You know, like I used to care about work in a certain way. And now if you called me up tomorrow and said, you and your wife and your baby are going to be able to live and be safe and secure and be happy, and you're going to have a happy home life. And the job I have for you, if like some commissioner of the entertainment world came to my home and said, Alec, we reviewed your case, and the job we want you to do now is we want you to host Jeopardy. I would host Jeopardy.
Well, and you're hosting Here's the Thing, which is a good way to remind us in the show business context that it will begin, once again, featuring Alec Baldwin in conversation. Yeah. The first one is with Ira Glass, and I've enjoyed this conversation very much. I wish you much success and good luck, and redemption, since that's what some people feel you need, but I don't know if you need it. You just need a happy home life from the sounds of it.
I just need to host Jeopardy.
Good to have you with us. Appreciate
the
time.
You.
You've been listening to a special edition of Forum. Our guest was actor Alec Baldwin, who is set to return as host for the third season of the public radio talk show Here's the Thing. The first episode airs on KQED Public Radio on Saturday, January 3rd at 2 p.m. Stay with us for another program from our archives this Thanksgiving.